Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The press release from the New Hampshire internet company Dyn reads something like something hot off the police blotter because it is, in fact, talking about a crime that took place last Friday. It reads like this, quote, approximately 7 a.m. Eastern, Dyn began experiencing a DDoS attack. During that time, some East Coast users were unable to access sites of some marquee brands of the internet, such as Netflix, Twitter, and the New York Times. It then goes on to say a second wave of attacks occurred just before noon, then a third. Well, service was restored, but the attack remains unprecedented because of how it happened. Hackers hijacked tens of thousands of web-enabled devices, that Internet of Things, some of which might be in your house right now, to swamp the New Hampshire company that directs global internet traffic. So many questions, such as, is this a glimpse of even bigger attacks to come? Joining us now to help us understand all of this is Engin Kurda. He's a professor of computer science at Northeastern and director of the Northeastern Information Assurance Institute. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I think this particular attack caught a lot of people's attention because of the sites that were taken down. But let's take this apart a little bit and understand the specifics of it. First of all, Dyn. It's a Manchester company I'd never heard of until Friday. What does it do?
Right. So they basically allow a lot of people to connect to these very popular services. So it's basically a backbone service that redirects the traffic, and they allow people to connect to their most popular services like Netflix, Twitter, et cetera.
And it does this through doing what? I mean, internet backbone meaning what? If I'm like typing in Netflix, which I couldn't get on Friday from my house, how does it go through Dyn and then to Netflix?
Right. So, you know, a backbone service could be something like the domain name, right? So when you're connecting to, say, Netflix, usually we have these domain names that map to IP addresses. So your browser would need to first find out, hey, what is the IP address that this matches, right? And then the IP address will be returned, and your browser would then connect to it, right? So that's just an example of a backbone service that somebody might actually provide. And they would also reroute a lot of the internet traffic to these very popular services because, you know, they are popular, so they get a lot of traffic.
So these are very, very important gateways
exactly.
then, to the
exactly.
internet, which is why, again, Netflix, Twitter, Amazon, the New York Times, just to name a few, were inaccessible for a while, not because their sites were offline, but because Dyn was offline.
Exactly. Right.
Now, how did Dyn then get taken offline by these hackers?
So what we saw was a classic distributed denial of service attack, which is basically actually a relatively straightforward attack where a lot of devices connect to a popular service. Because the demand is so high, that service is not able to respond anymore and is basically stops, you know, responding and because the load is that high, right? We call this distributed denial of service because, you know, maybe you're getting a million requests per second, but the attackers are able to connect to the service from multiple devices that they have compromised, and maybe it's 10 million connections per second. Because the load goes up dramatically, the service stops responding or is not able to cope with all these incoming requests.
I see.
So it's that straightforward attack, actually, that we've seen in the past, too.
Okay, so it's distributed because it's coming from many places and many
right.
devices
right.
at once.
Right.
Now, okay, so the key thing here, though, what seemed new is that it was these very simple web-enabled devices. I don't know, what, cameras,
right.
DVRs, baby monitors, things like that?
Possibly, right. So in this case, web cameras were involved. I've heard that some DVR machines were involved, routers were involved. So things that people typically have at home, they connect to the internet directly, but that are unfortunately typically also not well secured. So, you know, Internet of Things is a great concept. You know, progress is great, technology is great, but unfortunately we're not doing a good job securing these devices. And it turns out many, many of these devices were actually compromised, so they can be used in an attack like this.
Okay. And they were compromised specifically by something called Mirai?
Right. That's the name of the malware,
name
of the botnet that had compromised these devices. Again, what really happens is that if you have an internet camera at home and you haven't secured it, so you still have the default password or you choose an easy password, attackers can crawl the internet, find these devices, try out a couple of standard passwords, and they might be able to log in. So part of the attack, part of the compromises was because of this. So many cameras had bad passwords. These guys had standard passwords they could use, and they were able to remotely log in and then turn that machine into a malicious computer that was sending out these requests.
I have to say, it's a little disconcerting to think that these seemingly innocuous devices that many people have in their homes could be so easily compromised and then used towards malicious attacks. I mean, in this case, it definitely caused a major internet disruption and certainly business disruption for companies like Netflix and Amazon. But it's got to make you wonder if, you know, in the future, could we see these same devices being used for some more significant attacks? I don't know, terrorist attacks on key infrastructure, electronic infrastructure anywhere in the world.
Right. Good question. And unfortunately, I don't think we can rule that out. So, you know, scientifically speaking, there have been studies that have actually looked at these IoT devices, and people have discovered that they do have vulnerabilities that the attackers are compromising. But this was probably one of the first public actions that actually took place with these IoT devices. So yes, we definitely need to do a better job securing these devices.
Well, so people in the internet community, in a way, they've seen something like this coming because the lack of security for Internet of Things devices has been the subject of conversation a lot.
Right. And also measurement studies that was actually, you know, looking at these devices on the internet and seeing that a lot of them were actually compromised.
Okay. Well, I mean, in a way, it feels oddly prescient now. But earlier this month, just on October 6th, we had a conversation with Hiawatha Bray, who's the tech writer for the Boston Globe. And we were, in fact, talking about the lack of security around items that make up the Internet of Things. And here's what he said. This was, of course, before last Friday's attack on the internet company Dyn.
You're going to be putting computers into every little cheap diddly thing out there. The companies that make this stuff are not going to spend money the way Apple and Microsoft do on constantly improving their products and patching security holes. It won't happen. If you buy a $100 device with a security hole in it, the only thing you're going to be able to do to upgrade it is throw it away and buy another one, and people won't. So these devices are going to be so insanely insecure, it's not even funny.
Definitely not even funny now that we've had exactly this kind of attack on Friday. I mean, Engin Kurta, given what Hiawatha said, can these devices be secured? I mean, yes, change the password, but is there any better way to secure them?
I believe so. Unfortunately, there is no silver bullet, so it would be great to find one solution, just fix these issues. But one thing we could potentially do is to disable access to these devices over the internet. So if attackers are actually able to connect to these devices and people just open up these devices to the internet, that's part of the problem, right? Because the attackers are able to actually log into these devices. So I can imagine, you know, having some sort of a solution at home that monitors these devices, maybe blocks the connections to them, right?
Okay, so blocked incoming connections.
Incoming connections,
okay,
exactly.
So they would be able to be active in your local, at home network.
Which is what I do myself, for example, at home. So okay. I cannot connect to my internet camera directly. So okay. I would need to do it through some other means.
But of course, that's major appeal of these devices.
Right. It comes at a certain cost. But like I said, there's no silver bullet, right? So to secure the internet, to secure people's homes, I think we need to do some of these things that are, it's a mix of technological plus educational issues, I would say.
Now, I was reading some comments over at TechCrunch, and one user said, well, they should just make it so that upon setup, the first time you set up your new internet-enabled camera, that you're required to change the password. Would that do something to make it more secure? But other people have been saying, like, it's just really hard for the average user to make these changes in some of these devices.
Right. I think a good example of that is the typical router you buy these days. In the past, a lot of them came with a default password and a username. But these days, the company typically assigns a difficult one, but then they write it underneath the router, right? So you would need to look it up. So if more and more people would start doing things like that, then I think, you know, that would be not a bad solution, at least for default passwords.
I mean, that shouldn't be too hard either. Just a random string of numbers should be
exactly.
Very easy to generate.
Exactly.
Okay, so what about, so that's the sort of how they did it. I don't know, my home suddenly feels like a less secure place. But, okay, what about the who? Do we know yet? Do we have any idea who might have done this?
Scientifically speaking, no, because attack attribution is very difficult. So we can, you know, whatever I say, whatever I claim would be speculation without more data. You know, it could be a country testing the infrastructure of the U.S. So I've heard theories like that, which could be possible. Or it could just be teenagers who are bored and who just wanted to launch an attack. It could be someone who wasn't happy with Netflix. So in theory, it could just be anyone launching these attacks, right? Someone who had access to this botnet that launched the attack. But botnets are also typically rented out. So, you know, maybe it's not your botnet, but you can rent it to launch an attack. So that's also possible.
Could we see copycats like this? I mean, I've been seeing that the source code for the software is floating around on the dark web. So maybe, like, could other people just pick it up and do the same thing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've actually seen this in the past with other botnets a decade ago. So when source code leaks out, other people start adapting the code and using it in their attacks. For example, I think the Tokyo Olympics will be interesting because at least the people who are running the security there are concerned that these IoT devices will be involved in attacks against it. So there's definitely concern in other venues.
I'm also wondering about taking us back to this question of, you know, could there be bigger things to come? Because as you mentioned, there's a question of scale. There are some people out there who say that we've been seeing not so public DDoS attacks like this in the recent past. A couple weeks ago, I had a conversation with Bruce Schneier at the Berkman Center. Obviously, he's a big name in internet security, and he said that members of the internet community had been telling him that, hey, there are these DDoS attacks going on internet backbone companies that just weren't so public. And he wondered if they were a dry run for a larger takedown. So here's what he told us back in September.
What I found, and this is talking to people who are remaining anonymous, unfortunately, that there is someone who is trying to figure out how to do this at scale. Mm-hmm. They're launching these attacks not to take down the sites, but to figure out what it would take to take them down.
Now, at the time, Schneier had been saying that the DDoS attacks he was talking about may have had the hallmarks of governments trying to test out internet weaknesses. He doesn't necessarily think that Friday's attack was the same thing. But again, I just ask you, like, are we sort of just, did we crack open the door of things to come, whether it's from governments or black hats?
Possibly, yes. So we can't rule that out. This was an interesting attack in the sense that IoT devices were used. And I think there's no doubt that more IoT devices will be used in the future because, you know, other people who see these attacks will probably be motivated by them. They'll see how effective they are. But it's really difficult to say if this was an attack launched by another government. What really concerns me is attacks against 911 services and other things that might actually rely on the internet. So we might see things like that would affect us more than this. So this was maybe an experimental run. It's possible.
So can we do anything to make the internet backbone companies like Dyn more secure? I mean, is it something that should receive more, I don't know, government assistance? Or given the nature of the fact that they are distributed attacks from millions of individual devices, is it hard to protect against these?
It is very hard to protect against these attacks. This is, you know, ongoing research. I don't think a silver bullet exists. And these are things that we've known in the past as well. So DDoS is actually not a new attack. We've seen it even 15 years ago. Backbone companies or large companies like Google typically deal with it by putting in more resources. So if we see that this is an issue, maybe some of these companies will start putting in more resources so that, you know, attacks like that are less effective.
Oh, so the servers can actually handle the onslaught of a request.
Exactly.
That just seems like a never-ending recipe for
an endless
internet war.
Right. Arms race, unfortunately. That's true.
Well, Engin Kurda is professor of computer science at Northeastern University. He's director of the Northeastern Information Assurance Institute. He's been talking to us about Friday's unprecedented attack on a New Hampshire internet backbone company. The attack came from tens of thousands of internet-connected devices, and it had a pretty significant effect on the internet on Friday. Engin Kurda, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Switching gears here, as national rhetoric about immigration immigration policies has heated up, the number of refugees from Syria relocated to Massachusetts has in fact doubled in the past year. For a sense about how they are settling in, WBUR's Shannon Dooling visited one of the oldest resettlement agencies in New England.
In the basement of the First Baptist Church in Lowell, newly arrived refugees from Somalia stand shoulder to shoulder with new arrivals from Afghanistan and Syria. They're all sifting through sweaters, scarves, jackets, and hats, looking to stock up ahead of the cold weather, while children hammer away on the keys of an old piano.
I don't think they're ready for a New England winter, so I think this is really good.
Amanda Mujica of Belmont helped coordinate this clothing drive for the refugees. They've all been resettled through the International Institute of New England, which has been operating in Lowell for nearly a century. Mujica says she was shocked at the outpouring of donations from around Greater Boston.
It's been outstanding. I mean, people come from the North Shore, from the South Shore. I think people keep hearing about refugees, and they're trying to think about ways that they can help. And I think this was a way they could make a difference.
Most of what folks know about refugees comes from news reports and headlines. But as more families resettle in places like Lowell, there's more interest in actually getting to know refugees personally. Cheryl Hamilton is site director of the International Institute's Lowell office. She says the organization is seeing an influx of people calling, wanting to get involved.
There's a lot of rhetoric right now against immigrants, so that's certainly drawing some interest. But also I think that the families are here now, and people are starting to connect with them, and like our Syrian families, and they're hearing about them, and they're telling other people, and they're getting excited.
The arrival of Syrian refugees has been especially scrutinized since the country's civil war began 5 years ago. In the wake of the Paris terror attacks last year, Governor Charlie Baker said he no longer wanted to accept Syrians until he learned more about the vetting process. Baker now says he's satisfied with the screening after learning that most of the refugees coming here are women, children, and families.
My name is Zainab. I came in here 4 months ago.
My name is Khalil. I'm from Syria.
Amina Hasso. صرنا 3 شهور جايين.
That's Zainab, her father Khalil, and mother Amina, three members of the Abdo family. The four youngest children are in school. The Abdos are among the more than 200 Syrian refugees who now call Massachusetts home. The family fled Aleppo in 2013 after living more than 2 weeks in the rubble of their bombed house, surviving on bread alone. Khalil says he remembers the exact date they left their home and began walking toward the Turkish border. October 24th, 2013. It's unforgettable, Khalil tells me through a translator. He says they walked for more than 7 hours, mostly single file, trying to avoid bombs planted along the road. They took a bus to Istanbul, where they stayed with family while they applied for refugee status. After almost 3 years, Khalil says they learned they were coming to Massachusetts. They were afraid of everything, he says. A new language, new culture, the transition. What would life be like here? But now they're very happy and grateful to be here. There were 68 Syrian refugees resettled here last year. That number is up to 155 this year. Again, Cheryl Hamilton of the International Institute.
It takes, on average, 2 to 4 years to even get through the resettlement process. So even if you'd applied for resettlement in 2012, we wouldn't anticipate you seeing you until 2014, 2015. So obviously those applications increased over the last 4 years, so that makes sense that now we're seeing the influx.
Hamilton also cites President Obama's increase in the national refugee quota as contributing to the recent wave.
They put in the jacket, some sweater, no, not more.
Khalil Abdo and his wife are at the clothing drive in the church basement, chatting with a few of the Syrians who came here before them. Abdo says he knows the winter here will be cold, but for now, he says the changing colors of the leaves and the cooler weather is very nice.
That report from WBUR's Shannon Dooling. Back in a moment, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.